Hello, I'm Richard Aidy. You're on Radio National. This is Life Matters. Good to be with you. Today, dealing with tricky people, whether they're a backstabber, a whinger, a bully, a competitor, a controller, an avoider, a poor communicator, or just completely up themselves. You probably know a tricky person. Indeed, you can't avoid them, but you don't have to let them ruin your life. Stay tuned for that. Have you ever worked overseas? You may well have. Many Australians do. And we're some of the highest earners too. Money's a big part of the attraction, of course, especially if you have sought-after skills in a lucrative field. But for many, the attraction of an overseas job is that it's a chance to live somewhere different and advance their career. That isn't to say there aren't any risks. Just recently, an Australian mine worker was shot in West Papua, and three Australians died in the Jakarta bombings last week. To get some perspective on how influential this risk is, I'm joined now by Isabel Metz, who's a senior lecturer in organisational behaviour at Melbourne Business School, and Ross Taylor, vice president of the Australia-Indonesia Business Council. Welcome, both of you. Ross, I want to begin with you.
Yes, hello, Richard.
What's the mood among Australian business expats in Jakarta?
Richard, I'll probably have a better understanding tonight when, at an undisclosed location, I will be meeting with quite a number of Australian expat business people. But certainly, since the time I've been in Jakarta, I only arrived here yesterday. I've had some meetings last night, and I guess the mood is probably in two parts. One, absolute grief as to what has occurred to not only our own Australian colleagues, but to several Indonesian people as well. And then secondly, probably a combination of anger that that this has been perpetrated on our friends here in Indonesia just once again.
Now, almost the first thing you said then, Ross, was at an undisclosed location. Would it previously have been a disclosed location?
Yes, that's probably right. I think that given just the close proximity to these events having occurred, Richard, I think they just felt it was prudent at this stage to perhaps keep the event a little more low profile, and in the circumstances that probably makes good sense.
Will this make the community, more the expats I mean, more inward looking and less likely to connect and be part of local culture?
Very, very interesting question. And I've lived with my family here for some years previously in Jakarta, and we've also been blessed to live in five other countries around the world. There's something uniquely different, if I can say, about living in Jakarta. I don't know why, but the expat community here and the local community here just seem to have this innate ability to, without being disrespectful of what's happened. I mean, this has been a tremendous shock to people, but it is quite remarkable how people in Jakarta, perhaps because of the size, seem to be able to brush themselves off and then just get on with life. And I guess the reality is that wherever we are in the world today, we do live with this potential threat that things can go very wrong very quickly.
How diverse is the Australian business community in the city? I mean, is it mostly people working for multinationals, or is it a bit broader?
Oh, no, it's very, very, very diverse. You know, obviously we have a very large government contingent here, and then we have people in the mining sector, health, of course, education is huge business between Indonesia and Australia. But then also, Richard, we have the bulk of the people are made up with SMEs, small and medium enterprises. These are business people that are selling products, services, from technology to foods. So the business community is extremely diverse. There's something like 1,500 Australians working in Jakarta alone. So we have a very large and diverse business community here.
Stay there, Ross. I want to bring in Isabel Metz, who's a senior lecturer in organisational behaviour at the Melbourne Business School. Isabel, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Do you think that companies will find it harder to recruit people to go and live and work in places like Jakarta?
Well, I I believe there will be a section of employees, of workers, who will now think the risks are too high. There will be still a section of the workforce who are prepared to go, who are quite resilient and do think that accidents and risks are taken every day, everywhere, so they're quite philosophical about it. Overall, I would suggest that the pool does decrease, though, and the costs for organisations will increase.
Well, that was sort of my next question. If companies or employers are having to spend more on security and perhaps more on salaries and other benefits in order to make it enticing enough, it will become more of an expensive issue for them, won't it?
Absolutely. What we see with multinationals and global organisations are that they assess their costs of operating in different locations depending on the risks, depending on political, economical, social, economic instability. And that has always been the case. What we see now is that there is one more risk that has cropped up. It's not the usual, say, we have a war for a limited period of time kind of risk, or we have an unstable government kind of risk, but it's a more difficult to pinpoint risk. We know it exists. We know locations that are more likely to be at risk than others. And this is just another factor that organizations will have to weigh when they consider first whether they're going to operate in those countries at all. And if they decide that they are, then definitely the costs will go up, not just in terms of security, but also in terms of having to pay more for those who are prepared to go.
Yes.
Because if the pool reduces, the supply reduces, but the demand is still there.
But as you've mentioned, and as I touched on when I was introducing this, one of the attractions of an expatriate position for people is that it's career enhancing. Now, how important, we're in an increasingly global economy, how important is international experience seen for someone's career?
If one works for a multinational organization, say for instance in finance, it's extremely important. There are a lot of industries where unless you have international experience, you will only go so far in the organization. It has, again, always been the case. It has also been the case and still is the case that multinationals operate in different countries, so they will usually give their talented employees or their high flyers an option of a range of locations where they can go to. So usually there's not only just a one place, and it shouldn't be the end of one's career, but it's going to be much more difficult now to make choices.
On Life Matters today, we are talking about this, the idea of risk when it comes to taking up an expatriate position, given, I suppose, recent events in Jakarta is very much focusing people's minds on this at the moment. Yes. But, I mean, it's not just Jakarta. I mean, if you were working in London 4 years ago, you would have woken or perhaps been caught up in the nightmare of the bombings of July of 2005. Several Australians were. My guests at the moment are Isabel Metz, who's at the Melbourne Business School, and Ross Taylor, Vice President of the Australia-Indonesia Business Council. Ross, it's not always easy to move partners and children. What about the fly-in, fly-out option, where the family stays in Australia and the worker, well, commutes, for want of a better word?
Yes, absolutely, Richard. And if I can just go back to a comment that Isabel made, and I think Isabel has made several very valid points there, particularly regarding the mid-size and upper-size companies. If I can just first make this point, too, is that I think that when you are looking at places in which to send your expat. Obviously, it goes beyond issues related to terrorism. If I can use Jakarta, for example, which happens to be a city I love very much, but Jakarta is a very polluted city, as is Mexico and other places around the world. There are constant traffic jams. And I do know the Australian government, for example, Richard, do define what they refer, not very nice terms, as hardship postings.
Well, there are several international ratings of which cities are good for expats and which are less good.
Yes, that's right. So the ironical thing is that people like myself, and ironically many government people who come here from Australia, find that once they've settled in, and I'll be interested in Isabel's comments on this, is that once they do settle into life in almost any city that they go to, actually really enjoy the lifestyle, and in addition to that, they get the bonus, if you like, of more compensation. So in some respects of expats, these so-called hardship postings can turn out to be quite financially rewarding, but of course culturally very rewarding too, and I think that's something we mustn't lose sight of. Certainly in my experience personally, I look back on my, I'm 58 now, and I look back on my younger executive life and think, would I have traded any of those experiences for both my children, who are now very worldly, and my wife? And absolutely not. I think it's been the most wonderful thing I've ever done in my life.
But you mentioned that there's various issues that go into whether a posting's a hardship, quote unquote, or not. But when it is terrorism, there's a malevolence behind that. It's not just the weather or a bit of pollution. And partners and children, wives predominantly, I suspect, have something to say about that. Is there going to be, do you think, within the Australian community in Jakarta, a bit of pressure about packing up and going home?
No, well, Isabel has made that point, and I think the real pressure comes perhaps not so much with the person themselves, but if, for example, say, if you have a wife and, say, two or three young children who are attending, for example, the Australian International School, which you may recall when the Australian Embassy was bombed, was actually subject to threats. Now, I think realistically you have to say, as a family person, you know, you might like all the things that I've just articulated, but you're right, the reality is, the first concern, of course, is with regard to my family. So in those circumstances, there's probably several options. Do nothing. Send your wife and children home. And my experience is that once families are separated, the outcome is not always that good.
No.
Or, as you correctly say, and particularly for people, for example, who live in Perth, where Jakarta is just under 4 hours' flight, there is the option of a fly-in, fly-out. The downside to that, of course, Richard, as I say, is that from a business and a personal perspective, once you stop living in a community, you actually don't feel that sense of belonging, and that's both, I think, quite costly from a personal perspective and a business perspective, and I'd be really interested to see what Isabel feels about that.
Well, Isabel, if I could come back to you, this is, there are two issues here at least, aren't there? One is for, as Ross has mentioned, you know, the personal and business perspective of the expatriate work. There's also the whole juggle for the family, isn't there?
Sure, there is. What I suspect will happen with Australians going to Indonesia, for instance, is what has happened with high-risk countries in the past is that usually the workers who go, be that usually they men, but they could be women, they will leave the family behind and they negotiate more travels back to the home country, in this case to Australia. Again, this would increase the cost for the organisation, but it would minimise the risk for the worker, and particularly for the worker's family, who would need to be more mobile in terms of going to school or whatever. I think Ross is completely right in saying that once that happens, for the individual there's this risk of being separated from the family, not integrating as well, is what we call, the culture shock. Usually with a family it's easier to adapt because you make friends through school or whatever. And that will become, just not available. That option is not there. I also agree with Ross that it's not good for families to be separated. So what they negotiate in terms of how often they will come back to their home country, in this case Australia, is going to determine how appealing it is for these workers to then go without their families to high-risk countries or countries that are now considered to be higher risk.
That is where we'll leave it. But thank you very much, both of you, for joining me today. That was Isabel Metz, who's a senior lecturer in organisational behaviour, actually, at Melbourne Business School. And also Ross Taylor on the line from Jakarta. He's vice president of the Australia-Indonesia Business Council. Very keen to get your perspective on this. If you've ever worked in a kind of expat position or have been married to somebody who did, and you've got a perspective on this, or... you know, maybe your children are going through this at the moment. abc.net.au/rn/lifematters. And a bit later on, we'll have your letters and calls. And before that, dealing with tricky people. I know a lot of you will want to hear that. But next on the show, the increasingly elusive school librarian.
The fiddle of Alana James with the Hot Club of Cowtown and their new album Wishful Thinking. They're great Western swingers, gypsy jazzers, and quite fine songsmiths. We'll feature this album where? Let's put it on the Daily Planet. When is that on? It's on afternoons at 2:20 and evenings at 11:20 on this network, Radio National, ABC.
Some say they're a dying breed, not the Tasmanian devil or the orangutan. I'm talking about the teacher librarian. Teacher librarians can help students with their research, access the right reading material for the school curriculum, and generally help improve children's literacy rates. That sounds good to me. So why are they on the decline, and how is this having an impact on schools? Mary Manning's the Executive Officer of the School Library Association of Victoria. Welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you, Richard.
Before we get to the reasons behind the decline of the teacher librarian, why do you think teacher librarians are so valuable to schools?
Oh, well, they're valuable because they can make such a positive impact on students' learning. The research is telling us that those schools which enjoy the services of a teacher librarian actually do have higher student achievement and improved student learning outcomes.
Because one thing we certainly see now is Googling for the answers to school projects. I was talking to a friend last night and she was saying her daughter just says, just Google it, Dad. Now, teacher librarians can really give students a different approach to that, can't they?
Oh, certainly. And, you know, they can also actually assist students in Googling in an advanced search kind of way as well. The sorts of search skills that teacher librarians can assist individual and groups of students with actually take them beyond just Googling to look at the range of resources that are available and even those more targeted resources that are actually most appropriate to their learning needs.
Actually, just how much are those related? The rise of the I suppose, the web and Google in particular and the decline of the teacher librarian?
I suppose there is a link. I can only comment on the situation here in Victoria where we have concerns with primary schools and a declining number of teacher librarians in primary schools. In secondary schools, we feel that school libraries are still being... we'd love to see them better staffed, but they're still being adequately staffed. And I'm sort of commenting on the government sector because the School Library Association of Victoria does, of course, represent all sectors. But if we're talking about in primary schools, I think, you know, there were cutbacks in the early 90s which did put pressure on schools making choices about employing specialist staff, and teacher librarians are seen in that specialist staff category, and so the staffing ratios didn't necessarily allow them to do that. Then the pressures of offering students good range of technology in the school then put further budgetary restraints on, and so I guess the decisions had to be made, and I guess there is a link. I think what we're finding now, of course, is that schools are saying, gosh, teacher librarians are the people that we need to link students both to the print resources, because we know that immersing students in a range of print resources improves their literacy, and we know that teacher librarians are the people to give students those very valuable skills to navigate their way through the very rich information world that we have at the moment.
Well, yes, and as that is only going to become more rich, and increasingly
absolutely.
you're going to need those navigation skills, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely, and a greater range of skills. The sorts of resources that when you and I were at school, Richard, we knew that if something was in the school library, somebody else had decided it was worth us having a look at, and that it was probably chosen because it was suitable to our age group and to our learning ability, etc. Now, with access to all the world's information at our fingertips, students need greater skills to actually evaluate, is this material even relevant or even authoritative? Those skills are quite sophisticated, and the sorts of work that teacher librarians can do can assist and give students sorts of, you know, guidelines, scaffolds, checklists, things to actually work through to actually say, is this material suitable for what I'm after? Is it telling me the right answer? Am I building up some background knowledge so I can ask a really good question as to what I really do want to find out about in my independent research project, rather than, of course, the old, what has become almost ubiquitous, cutting and pasting to respond. So, you know, teachers don't want students to just regurgitate information and give them a rote answer or a cut and pasted answer. They want them to look at a range of sources of information to make their own decisions and to actually produce a new piece of knowledge to give them.
On Life Matters today, my guest is Mary Manning. She's Executive Officer of the School Library Association of Victoria. We are talking about, the decline of the numbers of teacher librarians. And if my mother is listening, she's a retired teacher librarian, so I have tended to be positive about them. But there are many reasons for that, not just because my mother is a retired one. Can I put something to you, Mary? I mean, a key focus of the Rudd government's education revolution has been a laptop. Every year 9 and above. There's also, we talked about this just the other day, huge amounts of money for capital works. School libraries are our favourite, but there hasn't been a lot of mention of teacher librarians.
Exactly. I mean, we're absolutely delighted to see the investment in schools, in a laptop for every student above year 9. Absolutely a wonderful resource for them to have. And the infrastructure investment in school libraries, again, we were absolutely thrilled, and that's in the primary area. And that's where, in our case, in Victoria's case, there is a declining number of teacher librarians or teacher librarian positions in primary schools. So the investment in the infrastructure in the primary sector to provide schools with a new school library, we would love to see a parallel investment in staffing those libraries with qualified teacher librarians in order to really make that investment worthwhile. We need to value add to that investment in school libraries so that we do have, as as Julia Gillard mentioned, 21st century libraries and 21st century learning. We need to actually make the investment to have the staff and the resources available so that our students really do enjoy what that investment is offering.
It's worthwhile pointing out, I think, that we are talking about the state sector
mainly talking about the state sector because that's where our major concerns have happened here in Victoria.
There are more school teacher librarians in independent schools, aren't there?
The independent sector certainly recognises the value of the school library, and it recognises the value of the school library to those prospective parents who are coming. The parents want for their students a school library that gives their children access to books, computers, of course, a range of information. where their students are, you know, able to be guided to explore ideas, to relax and enjoy a reading, a book that captures their imagination, or to log into a website and find information and knowledge that engages and interests them. These are the sorts of things that the independent sector knows that school libraries offer. I'm sure that principals and administrators in the government sector would love to be able to offer those things as well, but I think the investment just needs to be made.
But see, if you are a teacher librarian, then the rational choice is, if you can get a job in the independent sector, is to go and do that.
Oh, well, I can't speak for those people who are making decisions about their careers. I know that in the secondary sector, in the government sector here in Victoria, there's plenty of jobs for teacher librarians. And I guess you would apply for those positions that suited you geographically and philosophically. But yes, possibly, particularly in primary, there are more opportunities for employment at this moment in time, and we're hoping to change that, Richard.
If that is so, who is running the libraries in primary schools?
In primary schools, not all government primary schools
no.
have access to a library, and that's, you know, I mean, that's very much a case of numbers as well. There's some very small primary schools where, in fact, small classroom libraries have always been that which is available to the students. There are, I know, there are probably school libraries lying perhaps unutilised in the way that they should be, and they're not necessarily being kept up to date with the latest resources and fabulously engaging collections that students really should have access to. And many of them are being managed very effectively by a library technician, but the library technician does not have the responsibility of adding, of value adding in terms of learning, in terms of knowing the reader, knowing what would, take their imagination with their reading and so on. So that's really just a storage area and a management area so that everybody knows where the resources are. That's not my concept or our shared concept of what a school library is about.
Mary, thank you very much for joining us today. That's Mary Manning, who's Executive Officer of the School Library Association of Victoria. And again, keen to hear from you on this. Please write and say nice things about school teacher librarians, so that my mother does not give me a hard time. Actually, that's not a good enough reason. I can't see that they're anything but a good thing. abc.net.au/rn/lifematters. Now, a bit later on, we will have some of your letters and calls. We always do, of course, every Wednesday. But coming up, how to deal with tricky people. Yes, tricky people. Tricky people can cause you grief. I'm sure you can think of one or two in your life. But they're often the movers and shakers among us. In office politics, relationships and families, there's almost always a tricky person, a bully, a backstabber, a complainer or an avoider. And that I've barely got started. And they can make your life hell. But luckily, the psychologist Andrew Fuller has dealt with thousands of tricky people and their victims over the past 25 years, and he joins me now. Hello, Andrew.
Morning, Richard.
What impact do tricky people have on the rest of us?
An enormous. They can infiltrate our lives and send us really reeling, I think, and wailing and gnashing our teeth, losing sleep and chatting to other people that have no power to change them. So they can really affect our lives and toxify them.
Toxify. Is that a word? I like it. We'll go with it. We're all a bit tricky to an extent, but how do you categorise truly tricky people?
Well, I think, yes, we all have tricky behaviours from time to time, but there are people that almost make a life calling out of their major way of interacting with other people is in a particular style to sort of domineer the other person and also to avoid anxiety on their part. And those are the people that really plague other people's lives.
Yeah, you come up with, 8 or 9 categories? There's the backstabber, the blamer, the bully, the high and mighty. I will come back to all of these. Controller, the competitor, the avoider, and the poor communicator.
It was fascinating. A few years ago, I put out a book called Tricky Kids, and people kept coming, and I think we talked about it at that stage. And just after that, people would keep coming up to me and saying, you know, I used to be married to one of those, or that was my boss, or my father-in-law, or my mother-in-law. And so I started then to analyse, and I collected thousands of stories of people's tricky relationships with other adults, and started to sift through those and to really think about what are the patterns here, and they're the categories that we talked about.
Yeah, I remember doing something on psychopaths a while ago, and we're not talking about psychopaths today, but the strategy if you encounter a psychopath and you're sure they are one is to run away, because you can't beat a psychopath. But you can't run away from all the tricky people. There are many more of them than psychopaths. You've got to find ways of dealing with them.
That's right. I mean, psychopaths are still statistically quite rare.
Yes.
And thankfully so. But tricky people are much more prevalent, it would seem. So they're the people that aren't really in that area of absolute, you know, malicious kind of behaviour. But at the same time, they're pretty self-centred, they're pretty self-obsessed, and they're pretty painful to be around.
Mm.
The thing that I found was very interesting was that people, when they spoke about the tricky people in their lives, had rarely undertaken any strategy to improve the relationship. What they'd either done was either run away from it and just
yes.
basically move on to another workplace or a different relationship, or they'd just suffered in silence. They were basically paralysed by these people. They're like the rabbit in the headlights, really. They had nowhere to go. And so I was really thinking about, well, how can we help people then just to start to develop some strategy, some insight to think about ways to interact with these people and perhaps, hopefully, improve their relationships.
The other one, of course, which doesn't work either, the other approach is to suffer in silence when you're around the tricky person, and then when you're not around the tricky person, when you're with your partner or a friend, then unload on them. They can't do anything about it.
That's right. You're seething away, and then basically you go home and you tell your family about it. They don't even know this person, but basically they hear it in endless amounts, and they just get bored silly, of course.
Well, you encourage us to conduct a cost-benefit analysis as to whether it's worthwhile continuing your relationship. How do you do that?
Well, partly you really need to sit back. I mean, the one thing, of course, that you get tempted to if you really are confronted by a tricky person is to fire back, you know, all guns a-blazing, you know. And, of course, the problem with that is that these people are far better at arguing and far better at fighting than you ever will be, because they've spent a lifetime honing their skills. So, of course, the thing that we have to do is just sort of draw back for a little bit and start to think strategically and analytically about it. The first thing, I think, is to try and do a cost-benefit analysis. So you're really starting to think about, well, what are their assets? What's their power position in the family or the business or in the social situation? Who are their major contacts? Who are mine? How able am I to basically control my anger? How able are they? So there's a whole series of things that we need to weigh up before deciding, is it the best idea to act? Is it best to depart the relationship, or is it better to bide my time now, build up my assets so that I'm going to be in the future in a more powerful position to act? For an example, if we look at, say, the backstabber and white anter,
yes,
and they're a group that will basically spread insidiously bad news about you. And if left unchecked, that news, well, as we know, it sticks, basically.
Yep.
So bad news, basically, people believe.
They're nice to you, to your face.
Oh, marvellously charming, smarmy. Beautifully, friendly, and then behind your back, they'll basically do you in. And so you'll hear news that other people are reporting, which is quite inaccurate. And so left unchecked, they will be your own negative PR agent for life, really.
Mm.
And they can ruin your career. They can do incredible things that ruin your reputation. So they're a group that you actually have to eventually address.
Yes.
There's no choice. But
You can't kill them, obviously. But
tempting as it may yes. be at times. One of the first things that you have to do is, of course, to then think about, well, how do I go on a positive PR program about what is the truth, what I really do? Now, Australians are incredibly poor at doing this. We live in a culture that we don't like to blow our own trumpet
no.
at all. role, which I really love about our culture, but at the same time, I think it leaves us sometimes as a sitting duck for these sorts of people, because if there's bad news around it, it just spreads and builds up, and we're powerless to do anything about it.
You don't encourage the people to start their own whispering campaign about these white anters.
Well, white anting a white anter is, again, problematic because, well, you turn into a tricky person yourself.
That's you. And you're probably dealing with someone with more skills than you.
That's right. They've got more kind of connections and probably more ability to undermine you than you have them.
What about, because that's all very well if it's a kind of peer or somebody vaguely within your group at work, but what about if they're your boss? Not necessarily a white-hander, but a bully or a tyrant. I mean, that is very difficult to deal with.
It is, and sometimes, obviously, the best course is to depart. But before you do that, because what I found was that people that just up and left were haunted by these people. Years and years later, sometimes 20, 30 years later, they would still look with a grimace of pain when they spoke about these people. So unless you do something to try and address it, it's almost as if you're left with this awful kind of, you know, I suppose, post-traumatic stress, really, in many cases. And so these, in some ways, you've really got to start to tackle it. Now, partly, of course, when you've got a boss who's a bully and tyrant, they're going to try and lord it over you, they're going to try and control you and so on. And so partly the first thing that you need to think about is learning about them. One of the things that, having worked with thousands of victims of bullies, the thing that really stands out to me is that bullies are rarely self-analytical people. They're very not self-aware. They're aware of everybody else because they want to lord it over them, but they're not actually examining their own kind of patterns. And so the first thing I often recommend to victims of bullies is to basically know your enemy, know where they move, know what they're likely to do before they're even going to do it, know their major sort of modus operandi, so that you've really got, it's almost like an examination in a very cold, clinical way. The second thing, of course, that we recommend for victims of bullies is to practice the art of invisibility for a while, so to break the pattern up, to be where the bully is not, because you'll probably know more about their likely pattern of movements than they will, because they're not self-reflective, and so you can actually start then to shape for a time just to be out of their way. The third thing, of course, is then deflection, to think about how you might disempower the terms or the actions that the bully's doing. That's a more complicated process, but it's actually one that's very important to then feel as though you have some power to actually not be hurt, not be really gripped by whatever the bully's doing.
So, right, okay. On Life Matters today, we are hearing about how to deal with tricky people from Andrew Fuller, who's spent some considerable time dealing with the victims of tricky people, and indeed tricky people themselves, and has now written a book, Tricky People, How to Deal with Horrible Types Before They Ruin Your Life. That's going to leap off the shelves with a title like that. Can we move on to the blamers and the whingers and the whiners and the moaners? And these people... For these people, a day without offloading a few problems is a day wasted. Now, but you say they can actually be useful.
Well, they can. These are, in some ways, the canaries in the coal mine. So if you're actually in an industry and you've got a blamer and whinger, and let's face it, which workplace hasn't? Mm. I mean, these are the people that sort of gather around the water cooler and basically complain about the organisation being run by a pack of incompetents.
Yes.
But they're the people that basically will tell you the bad news before anybody else. So if you really want to find out what's going to be the negative reaction to any scheme, your blamers and whingers are a wonderful group to basically put it to, and to say, okay, you know, pick the flaws out of this. If you want to be particularly sneaky, of course, what you can then do is give your blamers and whingers the job of selling the idea of a new proposal to everybody else. That's quite amusing.
So you're kind of saying to them, you just want to have a whinge about this, or do you want to find a way of doing something about it?
Well, that's the big problem with blamers and whingers, of course. They make complaints, they offload all the responsibility, and people basically try and help them. I mean, people, you know, but despite having written a book on tricky people, I believe that most people are basically good people.
Mm.
And most people basically say, oh, there's a complaint, I'll try and solve it. I'll run around and try and make things better for you. But of course, not realising that these people are just truly addicted to the art of the complaint.
Can I ask you about controllers and micromanagers? There's a fine line here between being a control freak and just good attention to detail. And I ask this as a man who has two executive producers, both of whom have meticulous attention to detail. He says carefully.
Well, I do like my airline pilots and my surgeons and my executive producers to be controllers, because I think it's rather handy to have. But at the same time, there is a line across, which really emerges dramatically. And so there are people that can rob you of your own rights.
Mm.
And they can do it in the most interestingly charming ways.
That's right.
So controllers don't have to be kind of nasty and forthright. They can say, oh, Richard, you're looking a bit tired. Perhaps you've taken on a bit much. Perhaps we should alleviate your load, put your feet up.
And actually, under the EPs have never said that to me.
I'm certainly sorry to hear that. And so that under the sort of nicest circumstances, you can just find that they take over things for you. They'll take over your booking diary, or they'll take over answering the phone for you, basically, and sometimes pass on the messages and sometimes not, because they like to control the flow of information. So they're a very powerful and insidious bunch.
But they're useful too. They do good things.
That's right. In fact, that's the one thing that's the mixed message, I suppose, about tricky people, is these people are dynamos. They get a lot achieved in their lives.
Yes.
And they use those methods because they work for them. And they work in the world. The problem is they cost them at the same time.
And as you said before, you don't want an airline pilot who's not into control.
Yeah, that's right.
You want an airline pilot who's very into control.
Oh, that landing
and pays attention to detail.
That's right.
As this chat of ours has gone along, some people may be experiencing a spark of self-realisation. How easy is it to undo the tricky habits?
It takes a bit of endurance and persistence. I think it is an alarming thing to basically sit, and believe me, it wasn't alarming to write this book and basically realise, yes, I've done that and I've done that. And so you're basically aware that all of us can be tricky people from time to time. So it takes a bit of persistence. I mean, you've got to be, on your alert to looking out for your major game plans, how you characteristically interact with people, and is that very productive? One of the things that
But it is productive. I mean, that's why these behaviours persist. It's just easier to let these tricky people do what they want, in a way, isn't it? If you're not a tricky person, or if you're not a tyrant and you're having to deal with a tyrant, it's just much easier to try and keep out of their way than anything else.
But if you're the tricky person, and we all are at times, it costs you intimacy. So basically what happens is people stay away from you a bit, they avoid you, relationships get a little bit more distant, people get wary, and you find essentially that some of these very, very successful people at the top of corporate ladders are very lonely people.
Actually, yeah, you can't. Throughout the book there's lists of enormously famous and successful people who are all tricky in different ways. So, you know, Noel Coward, Ronald Reagan,
yes.
George W. Bush, all tricky in different ways. And I'm wondering if true success is slightly about dysfunction.
It's an interesting idea, I think, that in some ways to be that single-minded, obsessed focus, you've really got to in some ways be fairly ruthless about it generally. But hopefully, at least in your own personal life, you start to then clean up your act and don't translate it. I mean, one of the things that in therapy that I've had to deal with over years are some of the families of the high flyers who basically enact these fairly kind of, I suppose, powerful manoeuvres in the business world, but then come home and repeat exactly the same pattern on their children, their wives or their husbands. And it's a fairly bleak picture for them.
All right. So tricky people are sometimes very successful, as we've just touched on, and they can have a lot to teach us. How do we, I suppose, accent the positive and eliminate the negative?
Well, I think we have to always be aware of ourselves and aware of other people and their patterns. So one of the things that I'm hoping that this book will give people is some tools to do is to really not necessarily diagnose people as one category or the other, but to have a look at the predominant patterns that they have in their interactions. We talk about two types of relationships in the book, one being seesaw relationships and one being escalator relationships. Escalator relationships are those that build up and up and up and up until there's often a massive kind of climactic anger or outburst of some type, both if you like, that dropped into the ground floor again before slowly then rebuilding up for the next battle. And we see families that operate like that and friendships that operate like that as well. The other one's a seesaw pattern where one person is generally dominant or more powerful or more in control or more in charge of how intimate the relationship is. And the other person basically is often the oppressed person, and that then moves around. Those two people swing like two people people on a seesaw, and that pattern over time. So what the reason why those two patterns are interesting is because what can feel like a temporary victory or an improvement in a relationship can just be a stage in the relationship.
Yes.
So, you know, we have an outburst and we basically go back to the ground floor in the escalator relationship. Everything's calm for a while, but just slowly it starts to build. So once you start to get aware of these patterns in relationships, it then places you in a position to think, well, is that really what I want? And how do I contribute to it? Because that's the other thing, of course, is that we are players in this. Once you're actually interacting with a tricky person, you're rarely neutral. You're often going to be behaving in some of the tricky ways yourself.
Andrew, thank you for coming in.
That's a great pleasure.
I have to say, my favourite cartoon in the book is someone who says, I've read Andrew Fuller's book, and it validates my position and you're wrong. And the other person says, I need to read the book. And the book is Tricky People, How to Deal with Horrible Types Before They Ruin Your Life. It's published by Finch. This is Life Matters. Get in touch via the website abc.net.au/rn/Life Matters if you know any tricky people or have any strategies for dealing with them. And coming up, actually, more of your feedback.
G'day, Gladys. I'm up for cash for comment, but no one offers me cash, so I'm not going to comment. But we will comment on political corruption as a global phenomenon on Late Night Live after 4 and after 6 in the West. Bring some money. LNL, Radio National.
I'm now joined by one of the aforementioned executive producers who's very mindful of her attention to detail, Jackie May.
Feeling very tricky today, I am. So look out.
We've got a weekly feedback.
We have. And look, let's start with some feedback to yesterday's show. We got an email from Karen about the interview with Mukesh Haikerwal. It was wonderful to hear Dr. Haikerwal on your program. He's been a tireless and reasoned advocate of common sense in improving medical policy and practice. I fully support his views as a person with complex medical conditions. It's a constant source of frustration that I don't have a consolidated portable record to present during medical emergencies or when encountering new health professionals. There's over-reliance on my ability to recall accurately 35 years of medical history, pathology tests, and technical details of medical interventions. My medical records are held by over 5 hospitals and numerous other specialist and general practitioners. I feel the privacy lobby have hijacked this issue for too long under the guise of protecting rights and not facing the consequences of an ineffective records system. The lack of consolidated records inhibits effective, swift decision-making at critical times.
And just on that, actually, related to it, the other year, I think beginning of last year, we did a story about MyVitals, which is an Australian firm that wanted to be a player in this field. And we heard just from them the other day to say the company's going to be wound up.
Yes, it looks like maybe a little bit ahead of its time, but hopefully that will be the future. Mm.
Now, yesterday also, we spoke about violence in older women, women over 45. It turns out that women who are violently abused by a partner, a quarter of them are 45 and over. And we've got this from Selkie. Thank you for the segment. I'd just like to add that sometimes neighbours can be perpetrators too. Josie is right about the need to break the silence. In previous years, I've handed out white ribbons and information on Women's Day on the streets of my local country towns. The number of women, often older women, who have approached me to describe their experiences of physical and emotional abuse is staggering. One woman had a broken arm as a result of her partner's assault on her. They all said that they felt the issue was swept under the carpet in the local rural areas and so never gets addressed. Please, can we have more segments on this?
Now, another subject that continues to get a lot of you going is the problems with the delivery of the BER, or the Building the Education Revolution, for those of you not familiar with what we're talking about. Now, we got an email from someone who wants to remain anonymous for obvious reasons. I'm one of the courageous principals referred to by Christopher Pine. I can assure you that a gag has been applied, as I received a phone call soon after going public from my immediate superior directing me not to speak to the media about the issue. I have great concerns about the inflated costs and the fact that only 2 projects have been targeted for completion at my school, when I have many more that I feel the allocated $3 million should adequately cover. The managing contractor assigned by the government also takes a base 4%, $120,000 in this case, and then there's a list of little surprises to which the contractor can apply additional management fees.
Got this one from James and Robin. There's another facet to the BER than the school principal's reactions, and that's the impact on the local communities surrounding the schools. which are the recipients of the government's funds. The haste to build a large multi-purpose facility at an Ivanhoe school has created a dangerous situation for the community by exacerbating traffic hazards in streets around the school. No traffic or parking studies have been undertaken, and this situation's worse for the fact that no community consultation's being allowed. All local planning laws and avenues of protest have been bypassed. We also got these calls.
My children attend the local state high school. The school has very poor infrastructure. It has the substandard toilets. The science labs are over 45 years old. Recently, the school applied for a grant for the labs and was knocked back. We've got two or three private schools within quite a short distance from the school that have much better facilities, and were recently given about $2.5 million for halls. I'd like to see the state school audited to ensure that their basic facilities are adequate before millions of dollars are spent on other facilities that may or may not be necessary. Thank you.
Hello, Greg Dolan from Mudgee. I'm a member of a group called Nitrous Oxide Out of Classrooms. We're trying to get some of the BER funding towards replacing unflued gas heaters. These are very damaging to children and teachers' health, and I think the New South Wales government have put a gag order on this kind of replacement, and I support what Christopher Pine is saying. We really need to get the gas out of the classrooms. Bye.
Hi, Richard. My wife had arranged yesterday to have the windows on the house cleaned, which she has done professionally once a year. She's had great trouble getting our window cleaner to come and do it. When he finally arrived, he tells us that he's not only working weekdays, but working weekends as well, cleaning windows in schools, which haven't been cleaned for years, and are now being cleaned because they have to spend the money. So that's one thing they're spending it on, having the windows cleaned. Not quite what Mr. Rudd thought the money would be spent on, I feel. Bye.
Perhaps money coming from a different pot. But anyway, thank you for those calls. Now, last week while you were away, Richard, there was a talk back about the bonding power of music.
I heard bits of that, yes.
Maestro Guy Noble, of course, was in charge of. Now, Gail's written, you'll laugh at my story. I've always loved the last movement of Saint-Saëns Organ Symphony. For me, that wonderful theme, stated so triumphantly at the beginning, is about what a wonderful thing it is to be human. As the movement continues, the theme tries to come through but never quite manages that glorious fullness. And we in our lives don't often reach the heights, but we try and try again. So imagine my emotion when I went in my 50s to see the film Babe. And under the credits, there was the Saint-Saëns organ theme. And I already knew the story of a little pig that knows you get on better with people by trying to understand them than by trying to dominate them. And then there was Farmer Hoggett's song to that tune. Babe always makes me cry, so that's why I couldn't phone in.
I got one here from Jason. I've fallen in love with the eclectic and curious music of the late Frank Zappa. I've never heard such unusual guitar playing or musical compositions as Zappa's music. I remember when I first heard his guitar solo called Watermelon in Easter Hay, I cried uncontrollably. Conversely, when I listen to his track Filthy Habits from the album You Can't Do That on Stage Anymore, I feel the underlying rage and torment that he managed to channel through his musical compositions. Zappa's social comments in his song lyrics are also an interesting observation to me. Thanks for that, Jason.
Now, just before we go, Dr. Adrienne Salleh has written about teacher librarians today, and she said, your conversation focused on information research, but it only briefly touched on the fostering of a love of literature, which I see as a very important role for trained teacher librarians. We need a nation of discerning readers, not only researchers, if we're to move forward in the 21st century. So thanks for that.
Thanks very much, Jackie. And remember, if you want to get in touch, the website's the way to do it, abc.net.au/rn/Life Matters, and the number is 02833 1430. Time to find out what's coming up next on Radio National with Ramona on the Book Show. Ramona, you're heading to the jungle today?
We are. We're fostering a love of literature and gorillas and a comedy of manners with Maggie G, whose book My Driver is a really interesting combination of the light and the dark, let's say. And also, I'm not sure whether Robin Hood is one of your abiding heroes. I know he's one of mine, but you know how he was nice to animals and kind to the merry men.
Mm.
Well, there's been there's another book written from another angle. Adam Thorpe's written a book called Hod, and this merry, there's no merry men, and Robin is rather a villain, and there's a lot of mugging and raping the townsfolk.
Does he still wear the Lincoln green?
Well, you'll have to wait for that.
All right, I'll find
out. I've got to keep something in, you know, reserve,
yes,
as my mother used to say.
I appreciate that. Join Ramona for something in reserve about, well, an alternative Robin Hood story, among other things, on the book show, which is coming up next on Radio National right after the news. Tomorrow on Life Matters, the not-for-profit sector and the economic downturn. A new report on how charities and the like are faring. Also, more Ryeside economics with Andrew Lee. And we'll preview a new TV series on ABC, Whatever, all about teenagers.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.